Colonel Mike Cabry has been in the Army for 22 years. He's traveled the world with the military. His most recent overseas assignment was battalion commander in western Iraq, a time when Sunni towns like Ramadi were among the most dangerous places to be. Early on, though, he says he figured out that most Iraqis just want to be treated with a little respect.
There's not as many door kickings. I mean, that gets a lot of press, and it looks good, and it sounds fun. But you get a lot more done with a knock on the door. Now, the knock may come at 3 o'clock in the morning, but it's usually a lot safer.
These days, Colonel Cabry is working as a teacher at the School of Advanced Military Studies in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. He's among those helping teach this latest strategy, the Army's counterinsurgency document, the COIN manual. And he says it's working. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
11 U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq this week. And this comes after further weeks of renewed conflict with Shiite militia. And so it's with this in mind that Ambassador Ryan Crocker and General David Petraeus and other military leaders come to Capitol Hill today to testify about the war. They are reportedly seeking $100 billion to pay for operations through September. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Michael Mullen, puts the current situation pretty bluntly.
It's going to take us a while to get to a point where the security sustains itself and becomes irreversible, and I think we're not there yet.
The military leaders under General Petraeus are asking Washington that troop levels not be lowered, and they're asking for more time to allow their strategies to take effect. At the heart of that is what's called the COIN manual, the Army's new plan to fight a counterinsurgency. It's a switch from the earlier U.S. military doctrine to rely on overwhelming force. Instead, it emphasizes cultural awareness, creating trust, a connection with locals. My guest today is one of the commanders who made this shift through his own personal experiences. Colonel Mike Cabry served in Iraq back in 2003, before the strategy changed, when he and his soldiers had trained for conventional warfare.
You know, for us to prepare ourselves, prepare our equipment, it only took a weekend. We were scrambling to get everything done, but it was a very long weekend. And then we had the Army brought in training teams from Fort Polk, Louisiana, where they do a lot of small unit tactical training, insurgent-type environment. And so this training team came up and then spent the next several weeks with us working on dismounted patrolling and mounted reaction to contact and convoys. And it kind of got us into that muscle memory of, okay, here are the actions you need to take in a certain situation. Culturally, we had very little preparation.
Well, I was thinking that what these guys were putting you through, your trainers at the time, were putting you through a kind of hard response reaction, right? They weren't teaching you necessarily to interact with the population that you were going to live beside.
Yeah, looking back on it, it was very much, here's how you survive.
Yeah.
Culturally, though, it was, you know, hey, here are some handouts, here are some language things you can use, little, you know, cheat sheets to how to say hello and goodbye and my name is. That was about all the time we had, and then we were on a plane and going. So when we got into theater, we linked up with our interpreters. You had usually at least one individual that was a U.S. citizen, fluent in Arabic. But I think one of the things we learned right away is we had to spend time with these guys, just talking to them and asking them about the culture. And I took a lot of lead from those guys.
How long was it in country before you figured out that you really did have to make an effort to start interacting with Iraqis, that it wasn't either a defensive or an offensive military position that you were to maintain?
I would say for our unit, it was probably about 2 weeks.
Huh.
When we first went out, it was, okay, let's go on patrols, see what people are doing, and to just learn the lay of the town we were in. And as we were one of these patrols one day, I thought, this is crazy. We're just driving through to drive through, and they're looking at us like, you know, we're
Martians.
Yeah. So I said, let's stop this convoy and let's get out. There's a group of people. Let's go engage with them. Let's go talk to them and see what they think about us. And so I grabbed one of the interpreters, and the tensions were a little bit high, you know, not knowing what to expect, but we didn't see any weapons or anything like that. And we felt fairly secure with all our gear on and all. And happened to be that one of the individuals I went to go talk to was a local imam, and he spoke a very, very little bit of English. And then there was an English-speaking Iraqi that was there. And so as we started this conversation, it got into, okay, what do you expect from us?
You were asking
them
that.
We asked them, what do you expect from us? And, you know, they then went on to talk about they didn't want us interacting with sheikhs.
The tribal leaders, right?
But they were very careful about how they phrased it. And this is where nuances become very important, because there were different types of sheikhs there. There were sheikhs that were made sheikhs by Saddam, and the Iraqis there in that town at that time referred to them as the 80s and 90s sheikhs.
And then there were the hereditary sheikhs who they would respect, right?
Yes. Then there were the sheikhs that had tribal affiliation and names going back centuries with that rich culture. And I asked them, what do you mean don't interact with them? They said, well, we know that you can help provide us services here. You can help us with reconstruction. The sheikhs will come to you and ask for the contracts. And we just ask you to please consider where they get their help from. And so I'm now learning about this culture and how it's almost like a mafia, in that if those sheikhs got the contracts to build, and it's their family and their – or they're going to get the cheapest labor they can from outside of town somewhere and bring them in.
And you're thinking, this is not in the training manual. What is the right response
exactly
here?
So my learning curve is now vertical in this environment. Having these interpreters that were Iraqis were able to put it in perspective for me at the end of the patrols. We'd come back in and talk through it. You know, what was it they really wanted from us? What can I do? Who do I go and act with?
And how did you know you were getting good advice? I mean, you met an imam who said, don't deal with the sheikhs. You might very well have climbed down off your vehicle and met a sheikh who said, don't deal with the imams. And you know what I mean? And it's like, who am I cheering for?
Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, I guess. I look back and I say, in retrospect, I think we were lucky because I was so new at it that I was open to suggestion at the time.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The longer Colonel Mike Cabry stayed in Iraq, the more it became clear to him that the only way forward was working with the people in Ramadi.
We had a tip come in to us that one of the local Iraqis in the town was selling cars to be used as vehicle-borne IEDs.
Car bombs, yeah.
A car bomb. We decided to go out and talk to the people, find out where they lived, and see if this story made sense, because we were always skeptical. When you get tips come in, it could be because there's a neighborhood vendetta. You know, this dog went in my yard, and so I'm going to back at him and sick the coalition on him. So you just didn't go off half-cocked on things like that. So we started questioning this man and asked him about his son. His son was the one that was supposedly implicated in this car bomb ring. And as it turned out, it wasn't a son. It was an uncle we were talking to. And the uncle said, oh, you know, the son's gone, the father's gone. He's, you know, at a wedding in Jordan. And so we were very unobtrusive speaking with him, and all of a sudden a car pulls up, and it's the father now, who is supposedly in Jordan at a wedding for the next 3 days. So we kind of separated him.
Now you know that you weren't really getting the straight goods from the uncle.
First,
yeah, from the uncle.
Okay. So then we talked to the father. The father says, yep, my son sells cars, and he does modifications to them, but we're using it for fuel. Black market fuel. And we cut the back end out, put fuel tanks in there, and we can fill them up with fuel and move it around the neighborhood and sell fuel. He's very honest with us. And he said, in fact, he lives in a house really about 3 miles from where we were in the same town. So he said, okay, we'd like to go visit him. He goes, I'll take you there. We go up, and the tensions are a little bit high, nerves a little bit high, because we don't know, is this guy going to lead us into an ambush or whatever? And so we went in there very cautiously and pulled up at the house, and there was an old lady there. And it's amazing the families, the way they live together. And the father that took us there, he said he didn't want to go all the way up because he didn't want to be implicated as part of, you know, turning over somebody to the coalition.
Now you're getting suspicious because he doesn't want to go into wherever you're going, right?
But we said, okay. And so we said, okay, well, why don't you just stay back? But we kept him in his vehicle close by.
Right.
So he didn't run away completely. As we approached the house then, this old lady, I mean, I realized that she was petrified, so I took my helmet off. And that was kind of the routine. If we were dealing with women and older people, we'd take our glasses off, our goggles off, take our helmets off, point our weapons at the ground. And I took a knee to talk to her and ask her about it. And about this time, the son comes out, and he's talking with me, and we just got a lot accomplished, and we realized what was actually happening, and really found out that he was using his little kids to drive cars around to do black market fuel instead of sending. So we kind of admonished him for, you know, your children really need to be going to school. And we kind of realized that there was not a conspiracy, a car bomb plot going on here. It was a family trying to make a living.
But you never know, right?
Never know.
Going into a situation like that.
And I think the fact that we went in with a gloved hand approach, we gained a lot more. There was no animosity towards us.
You didn't kick a door down on this.
Didn't kick doors down. You know, our unit was probably reflective of many units over there. There's not as many door kickings. I mean, that gets a lot of press, and it looks good, and it sounds fun.
Yeah, it's dramatic. It makes good TV.
But you get a lot more done with a knock on the door. Now, the knock may come at 3 o'clock in the morning, but it's usually a lot safer.
Colonel Mike Cabry was a commander in Iraq back in 2003 and 2004. It was his experience, and that of many others, that led to some pretty dramatic changes in military training. They're now concentrating a lot more on trying to win over rather than knock over the local populace. Colonel Cabry says it's still war, though, and U.S. soldiers have to be constantly on their guard. One time, he says, a buried bomb, an IED, went off right next to his Humvee, and he wound up chasing the insurgent himself.
And I run up, and he runs down the other side, and I'm gaining on him, but because he's running in sandals, but I'm running in all my gear. And I'm yelling at him to stop in Arabic. And he stops, puts his hands up, and turns around. And then, you know, I point to the guys in the boat, and I motion with them with my weapon. And then I turn around to have the rest of the guys, okay, let's see if we can apprehend him, whatever we need to do to get him out of there. And I look around, and there's no one else.
Colonel Mike Cabry and the story of that chase, and the kinds of lessons that each such experience can teach. That's coming up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The commander of military operations in Iraq, General David Petraeus, is on Capitol Hill today making his case for continued support for the war in Iraq. General Petraeus is the man who helped transform military strategy in Iraq, encouraging his commanders not to just rely on force, but to engage and to listen to Iraqis. Colonel Mike Cabry was a battalion commander in Anbar province back in 2003 and 2004. He was among those who began this kind of local engagement.
The call to prayers on Friday are done over the loudspeaker of the mosque, the chutzpah. And you could listen to each mosque, and we had several of them in our town, and we would do that routinely, go and listen. What is the message that they're putting out? And then that was an opportunity to maybe go talk to these imams between sermons and say, hey, you know, we would really be helpful. I don't want to tell you how to preach to your people, but if we can try to, you know, dissuade them from this criminal activity, it would make it a lot easier for all of us. And so there were some imams that were very open to that and actually professed to their people to, hey, let's get along, let's work with the coalition that's here to help us. And there were a couple who refused to do that or would incite anger and resentment against us. And those we paid extra visits to go talk to them again and ask them kindly. And never did we threaten an imam like that. And it was never into the mosque, but it was they usually had houses somewhere that you could go and speak with them. So it was usually done very civilly.
And while you're busy trying to figure out how to deal with people in an interactive way, what's going on the military side of the blotter here? Are the mortars coming in? Is it starting to get increasingly dangerous for you and your soldiers there?
I would say it wasn't getting increasingly dangerous. It's always dangerous. But you don't know who was the insurgent. You didn't know really who you were dealing with in a lot of cases. And it took a very long time to form good, tight bonds with them, the local police chief and a few of the school principals and a local doctor and a contractor that we started meeting with on a weekly basis. So we called them town council, and they really enjoyed – it kind of gave them some credibility. And it's every Iraqi you see on the street and you stop to, what can I do for you? They'd have, by their culture, they have a story to tell you. Power, my water, I can't get this, can't do that. So we kind of started this town council just as a way, let's consolidate and what's going to be best for the community. This town council kind of formed a grassroots, I'm not going to say democracy, but a grassroots kind of organization that allowed these people to represent. I would go to this meeting and they would tell me, here's the concerns we have, what project we'd like to get started. And then the local police chief would talk about what he could do to help demonstrate that we as an organization, the Army, had learned how to start dealing with this culture.
Colonel Cabry says it's always a balancing act, though, between reaching out to the locals and protecting yourself. One time, he says, an IED, a buried bomb, went off right next to his Humvee.
Just before it went off, I looked to my right, and there was this big embankment, probably about 30 feet high, and it was a stretch of road we'd traveled many times, and then we were on our way to a memorial service for one of the soldiers, or actually it was a group of four soldiers. So there was about eight vehicles in this convoy, and when it went off, I had just looked to my right and seen an individual hiding behind bushes up on the embankment. And as soon as I turned back around from looking at him is when this thing went off in front of us, and so I yelled at my driver to stop, and he stopped the Humvee, and I immediately opened the door, jumped out, and then snapped back in the Humvee because I still had to hand my hook to my helmet, so it just pulled me back in, took that off, and then immediate reaction is to try to secure the area and make sure there's no other explosive devices. And if you have visual contact with whoever might have detonated that, then you attempt to capture him.
So where is this guy? What's happened to him?
He is now running up the embankment, and I'm watching him. So I take off after him with all the gear on, and I'm looking to my right as I get ready to up this embankment, and I see other soldiers to my right. So I'm like, okay, we're going to get him. And I run up, and he runs down the other side, and I'm gaining on him, but because he's running in sandals, but I'm running in all my gear. And I'm yelling at him to stop in Arabic. Finally, as he gets down to the water's edge, and right at there's a boat there with two or three other individuals in there waiting for him. He tosses something into the lake. And so in my mind, okay, that was what he used to detonate it.
Cell phone, something like that.
Cell phone, key fob.
Yeah.
And I yell, Keef, one more time.
Which is stop.
And he stops, puts his hands up, and turns around. And then, I point to the guys in the boat, and I motion with them with my weapon. And then I turn around to have the rest of the guys, okay, let's see if we can apprehend him, put flexi cuffs on him, whatever we need to do to get him out of there. And I look around and there's no one else. And so, yeah, it was it's all me now. They didn't have guns with them. So I wasn't in danger. I didn't know that,
at the time.
The adrenaline was running high and I was a little excited. And all of a sudden, Colonel Brinkley, the engineer battalion commander, comes over the hill and down.
This is the two old guys.
And then my sergeant major, who's the next oldest guy. So there's the three oldest guys are finally down here at the boat. And then got these guys and brought them back up the hill and over. And Colonel Brinkley, I think, gave a counseling session to some of his soldiers about the three oldest guys beating them up on the hill and down. But by that time, the quick reaction force from the camp we were going to had dispatched vehicles up to where we were, and so we were able to hand these guys over to them. And more than likely, they were taken away and processed. And then some of these guys are then released back out again because they weren't hardcore criminals at the time. They could easily be released back out into society. And we had one of those pop up in our neighborhood too one time. So,
yeah, what happened?
A guy that we'd captured early on with the help of the Iraqi police. I mean, they knew we were looking for him. Again, we had indications that he was responsible for building bombs to be put in the road. We went by his house several times and never found him. Then the Iraqi police called us one night and said, hey, we have who we think you're looking for. Gathered up the individual, and sure enough, it was the target that we'd had. About 8 months later, we were opening a brand new health clinic in the town which we were working in, and all of a sudden the doctor shows up who's going to be running this clinic, and my interpreter whispers in my ear, he said, sir, that's so and so,
the same guy.
And I looked and I thought, oh my gosh, it is.
What do you do?
Well, we just waited. He got up to give a speech before we did the ribbon cutting with this thing, and he proceeded to tell the local community that was gathered there how he had been an anti-coalition member.
A bomb maker,
that he'd done bad things. He actually said, I was sent to Abu Ghraib for 6 months. He goes, I was treated with dignity, respect. He told this great story about how he was treated and how he really wants to make sure that he supports this community and he supports the coalition. I mean, we couldn't have scripted anything better for him to say.
And if you'd walked up to him with your Oakleys on and poked him in the shoulder saying, I know who you are, yeah, you never would have got that.
There's no way you're going to run a health clinic that we've opened. It was just, I mean, that's one of those good news stories that it worked out well for us.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Now, this is one aspect of battling an insurgency that is toughest for the military command. Colonel Mike Cabry says this new counterinsurgency doctrine is encouraging young soldiers to get out of their Humvees, to take those sunglasses off, and to spend time talking with the locals. On the other hand, no one knows who or where the insurgents really are.
And it was just a continuous education. And then, like I said, that working with the interpreters, to have the interpreters explain about the culture and how important it is for an Iraqi to be able to see your eyes. If we wanted to send a message that we were very angry with someone and I was disappointed in the police chief or something like that, I might go talk to him and leave my glasses on. And it sent a message.
You're talking about the dark Oakleys. Yeah. Because you're a little more intimidating.
It's an intimidating thing. But if we wanted to just talk to people, and I think most of our soldiers realized it too. It didn't take a stick to the head or anything like that to teach anybody. They just kind of saw it intuitively.
Logically it makes sense, though, but practically, you know, halfway through one of these exercises, there's an IED and a couple of their friends are killed, and boy, you're starting all over again, trying to convince them that there's some purpose in trying to engage with Iraqis.
And that is a tough part. When an incident happens like that where you lose or have injured soldiers, the remaining soldiers in that unit, the immediate response is, let's go get them. And that's the role of a commander, is to ensure that the steps that are taken are always moving forward and positive, and explain to them, okay, if we go out to go seek revenge, we're going to create even more animosity, that we'll never win the battle, that it's got to be positive steps. As hard as it may be, it's okay to grieve about it, and we can really miss them, but if you take those negative steps and retribution becomes your modus operandi, you're always going to go backwards. In the new COIN manual that we have, I mean, that's spelled out very clearly, that sometimes no action is the best reaction. You know, let things simmer down. I think our guys understood it, and I think lots of them, the men and women over there right now, understand it. And that's why there's constant movement forward. It's just a very long process.
I can imagine it being equally difficult for you, though, on a personal level, because every time there's an attack on one of your soldiers, you're directly engaged with that, no?
Yes. And it is a lot of what you try to do is tie the enemy activity to the local community is allowing this to happen. Somebody has set a mortar up near the schoolyard and shot into the camp. So there's obviously somebody that's seen it happen and allowed it to happen. Now, you can't expect a lady to go out there and scurry him away. But what we did do is we said, okay, if you're going to allow this type of activity to happen in your neighborhood, then I'm going to be forced to concentrate more on security for myself and less on taking care of you. And I probably can't send my soldiers out here to help, you know, rebuild this school or put the lights into the soccer field that you really wanted, because I now need to protect myself. And after about 2 weeks, that message got across the locals. You know, they asked for meetings with us and, you know, assured us that it's not going to happen, and the attack stopped from that area.
Ever since Colonel Mike Cabry took up his teaching post at the School of Advanced Military Studies, he's found that the young officers, the ones who've served in Iraq, can bring back the details of their experiences to help shape changes in overall strategy.
There's a wealth of experience, and so you do tap into that, you know. What were you thinking? How did you evaluate the situation? What did you learn from it? Or when the second time you went back, how was it different? And now wrap those practical experiences in with a doctrinal foundation that we get in the military, and you have a very, you know, powerful education. It's more than just training.
See, that's the part I don't get, and it's largely because I've never served in a military, but my kind of rudimentary understanding of military doctrine is that there's one way of doing things, and you get in trouble as soon as you deviate from that way of doing things. It has to do with the line of command. No, but I'm talking history here more than anything else. You're almost at the other end of the spectrum now, where you're saying to these young officers, boy, you got to think. You have to, you know, assess the situation, ask all the right questions, and make it up on the ground, because that's what everybody has done before. How do you encode that in a doctrine?
Doctrine is a foundation. It's a base. And you have doctrine that really applies at low levels, and you have doctrine that applies at high levels, at the strategic level. What we're trying to teach these young men and women is that you can depart from doctrine. It's doctrine, not dogma. And that as long as you know where your roots are, if you can comfortably depart from it, that's okay. And it's the only way that we're going to adapt and continue to improve in what we're doing.
But does that mean at some point questioning authority or challenging authority?
I think it means questioning. I don't know necessarily authority, but it means questioning, and discourse needs to take place. And they're always taught that ethically and morally, by all means, question.
And tactical?
Tactical, it can be open for discussion to a point in time. If time is of the essence,
somebody has to make a decision.
You do have to trust, and sometimes a decision does have to be made, and you go ahead and make it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Like many of the soldiers and Marines serving in Iraq, Colonel Mike Cabry has inherited military history from within his own family. He says it gives him an interesting perspective when he compares what he's going through to what his grandparents experienced years ago.
My grandfather on my mom's side was World War II and Korean War. On my dad's side, his mother was a nurse in a MASH unit in the Korean War. We used to joke with her, you know, the hot lips Houlihan from MASH, and she'd get all upset saying, it was nothing like that at all. You know, we were not that undisciplined. And
did it bother her that people had this notion?
It did it to a little extent. I mean, she appreciated the show for what it was. It was a comedy. She really, you know, had a hard time with people that thought, oh, that must have been life all the time. Yeah. You know, this constant jokes and shenanigans going on. And she said it was much more serious than that.
Did she tell you stories about her time in Korea? Was she
very, very few. I mean, she didn't speak about it a whole lot, other than some of the friendships she'd made while she was there. How she was happy when she was done with her time. She thought it was very important she did what she did, but didn't see herself having the Army as a career. But she talked about the camaraderie that was developed with the unit before they went over.
But not telling you the stories, is that a clue to you, Mike, that stuff goes on that people don't want to talk about when they don't, you know, sit and say, hey, let's trade service stories?
I think it could be, but also I was much younger then. So I don't know if she realized it would have been an interesting story for me as a young child when I spent time with her. And the same thing with my grandfather. He'd always had his I Love Me room, kind of, you know, just
with the metal side,
kind of memorial room that, you know, eventually someday I'll probably have one of those things. But it was something that I really didn't ask a lot of questions about. I walked through and said, wow, because I wasn't old enough to realize the significance of the mementos and the memories that were in there. And so I don't think he felt compelled to impose it on me either. And he was just my grandfather. I mean, and I had a great time with him.
So he wasn't much of a storyteller either?
No, not until after I had, you know, graduated from West Point, had gotten 4 or 5 years of the Army under my belt, then he would talk about it. And then by that time, though, we'd only see each other for a week or two max, you know, over a year.
But he was then talking to a soldier, not just a grandson.
Exactly.
Right?
I probably spoke with him almost every week, though, when I was at West Point going through school. The end of the conversation was, and don't let him get you down. You know, that was his advice to me all the time. Don't ever let him get you down.
This past Veterans Day, Mike Cabry found himself sorting through the memorabilia of both his grandfather and his grandmother, both of whom served and have since passed on.
While we were going through things, my brother had helped take a bunch of the stuff out of their garage and the shed they'd had at that house. He said, yeah, I found all these footlockers. He said, I've opened up a few of them. He goes, I think you might be interested in it. Popped the first trunk open, and it was all of a sudden a flood from things I'd seen in those rooms that my grandfather had when I was 4, 5, 6 years old. They were there now. And I'd always kind of wondered, I wonder what ever happened to those things. He had these photo albums that he'd put together, just black binders, very simple photo albums. But in every binder was years of history. It was from the time that he was a small child. And then, you know, the next trunk contained every one of his awards and the write-ups that he'd received from his superior officers and the Bronze Star for Valor and war journals from you know, himself and his friends, you know, letters that he'd written.
But at this point, the stuff is starting to take on a kind of historical value, not just family value.
It is, yeah. Literally newspapers from Philadelphia Inquirer, you know, the 1945 war in Europe is over. Yellowing, a little wrinkled on the side, and we immediately put those into plastic bags and save those. It was just, it ran the gamut. And swagger sticks. As crazy as it sounds, you see the old military movies with
these
guys.
I thought those were just British, the swagger sticks.
No, apparently not. But he had a couple of those in there with his insignia from the chemical corps. You know, those things, it's just a stick. But that stick was held by somebody 50 years ago. That's a piece of art, a piece of treasure.
The Foot Lockers, perhaps more than any textbook or tactical manual, helped show Colonel Mike Cabry how much has changed for soldiers in the past 50 years. And I'll ask him where he thinks it's all leading in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The U.S. strategy in Iraq is front and center this week as military leaders come to Capitol Hill to report on the war. Colonel Mike Cabry was a battalion commander in Iraq. He now teaches military strategy. He says he's recently become interested in the way that a soldier's knowledge is passed along. He's seen it in his own family, recently sorting through the military memorabilia of his grandfather.
There was probably 8 or 9 foot lockers, big army steamer trunk size foot lockers. Some of them contain things, beer steins, you know, from Germany and all over the place. And some contained just random pieces of paper, you know, administrative documents that he'd kept from his time in the military. But I had to kind of pare it down to about a trunk and a half worth because I thought, well, I could take everything and then I'm going to carry around 9 foot lockers for the rest of my life.
And so, you probably got your own foot lockers.
My wife is going to limit me on the number of foot lockers I can carry around.
Tell me something, though. When you started to look through the foot lockers, were you finding out things about your grandfather that you didn't know? Were there stories that you could learn about his own military experiences that he hadn't told you? Were they part of that?
Yes, in a big way. I always saw him as my loving grandfather, loved spending time with me, you know, visited me at Christmas time and just was very a close, warm person. As I read through the accounts of his Bronze Star for Valor, at one point in time, his unit had come under fire. A couple of the mortar tubes were knocked out, more than several casualties. And the commanding officer was incapable of commanding, controlling the organization. So my grandfather, according to the write-up, had organized the rest of the men, got the mortar tubes back into firing action, and then continued on with providing the fires that were required during this attack.
He was probably a pretty young man when it happened, too, right?
Yeah, just in his mid-20s. And then there were pictures of him as a young man with his fellow lieutenants from that unit that were there. But I saw him as not just a grandfather then, but as a war hero. I don't throw that term out loosely. It was very significant what he was capable of doing in a very intense environment. And I guess my experiences, you know, more recently in Iraq, I had probably an even greater appreciation for what he was able to do.
These days, Mike Cabry is teaching officers counterinsurgency strategies for Iraq. He says it's a great shift from the kind of training his grandfather, or he, received.
When I entered the Army in the mid-80s and on, the Cold War was still on. I was over in Germany when the wall was still up. And so the foe we had was a known entity. There was a certain number of forces that we knew we were going to face, and there was mathematics involved in it, calculating how many rounds we could shoot and how far they could move and how many gallons of fuel. You know, it was all about the details, and almost battlefield calculus really was that. It was calculus. The instruction we have now, there's a lot more that deals with culture. We spend, you know, several weeks on just the identity of the Arab mind. We read complexity theory, systems theory, things that we didn't pay that much attention to.
I was going
to
say, there's a lot more book learning than I've had a lot
there is.
Of
I mean, the joke is that
for.
The course is called the Book of Night Club that we're
as
in.
As opposed to the Book of the Month Club.
So it's, but there's a lot of detailed discussion in each thing. And we provide practical exercises at the end of each major block of instruction to put the students through decision-making exercises. A tsunami hits the port of Karachi. What do we do? A humanitarian relief type thing. what is the role of the Pakistani government in this? How do we want them to be portrayed as we come in to offer this help? And oh, by the way, Karachi influences what's going on in Afghanistan. So how? What is the impact? What are the second and third order effects of what we need to have happen? So that the complexity of the problems we're given now is much greater than what we had 11, 12 years ago.
I mean, you've been teaching there for a year now. It sounds like you're doing as much learning as teaching.
It is. I mean, I learn every single day there. We put on a lot of our emails and all, you know, intellectual center of the Army, and I truly believe that.
I wonder if in the kind of training you're doing now, if you ever pause and think to yourself, wow, what would my grandfather think of the kind of training that we're doing where it may be in a given week we're far more interested in taking all these officers, all these men and women from all these different military branches and working on different aspects of Arabic language, Arabic culture, religion, rather than battlefield tactics. What would your grandfather think of it? What would your grandmother think of it?
I thought about that the other night. Now we have this conflict that's gone on that's allowed people to go, learn, come back, educate, go, learn. And I think my grandfather would be happy to see a mechanism in place where we really aren't just saying, well, the book says. We now have a cycle, I think, that allows us to bring these lessons learned and get them back into doctrine. And so our baseline changes a little bit each time.
Your grandfather wouldn't raise an eyebrow at the idea that how can you have rules if you keep changing the rules?
I would think that he would say, you know what, good on him for questioning a little bit. And I think we're a stronger military because we look for ways to improve. What do I know? What have I learned? And how can I go back and inform authority so that authority allows me to do more?
Colonel Mike Cabry is working this year as a seminar leader at the School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. He joined me here in our Chapel Hill studio. For fans of college basketball, last night was the big night, and Kansas takes home the NCAA championship. All this March and April madness reminds Dennis Streets about the one big basketball game in his own life. He wrote to me to say, quote, "I was part of a tour group of students to visit Russia during the Cold War." Now, this was 1974, and Dennis wrote that some of the U.S. students had expressed an interest in playing a friendly pickup game of basketball with some Russian students, and we got more than we wished. I invited Dennis to tell me what happened. His story starts in the Rusia Hotel in what was then Leningrad.
Well, we came down to breakfast. It was either December 23rd or the 24th, and we were going to have a leisurely or free afternoon. You could do whatever you wanted. And so it was announced that if anyone was interested in a game of basketball that afternoon, to show up at, I think it was like 1 p.m., and we would go play a game of basketball. And so there were about 12 or 15 of us who showed up, and we were put into a van, if you will, and taken across town and showed up at the Leningrad Institute. And when we got there, we were sort of taken off the bus and guided down an alleyway. We had seen a long line of people, but we had seen that at many places in the Soviet Union.
People lining up for food.
Right, stores and so on. And so we were taken into this side door into this large building and down a hall and into a locker room. And that was first indication that something might be amiss because there was a sheet of paper on the table that had some names on it that we recognized. It had names like Bobby Jones and David Thompson and Tom Burleson. And
these would be star U.S. college ball players.
And all from North Carolina or North Carolina State.
So you're thinking to yourself,
what is this?
Who do they think we are?
Well, we didn't even go there yet.
Okay.
And so we had to ask for some tennis shoes, and so they brought in a large pile of tennis shoes.
You found a pair that fit?
I found it pretty well.
Yeah.
And we didn't, and they brought in a large pile of orange tank top jerseys. And we went through those and found out something that fit or closely fit.
But you'd have had your own T-shirts and shorts, I suppose.
Well, right? We didn't. Most of us were wearing still jeans and then jeans, tennis shoes, maybe blue socks.
You were kind of a motley.
Very motley crew. And so we were in there a little while, and then we were again instructed to leave and followed someone out and went past a large plate glass window. And that was really the very first indication, other than that little list.
Wow, what did you see?
We saw a gym packed full of people. And worse than that, there was a team on the court in very nice warm-up outfits, dunking the ball and doing nice drills.
Oh, a team that looked like it knew what it was doing.
That knew what it was doing. We were walked down onto the court and then had to pretend like we knew how to do similar drills. And very few of us had ever played any organized basketball.
Was there any talent on the
team?
On your team? I mean capital T talent. Was there anyone there who was college-level ball player?
No, absolutely no.
Okay.
Certainly none of us had played on, as far as I know, on any college teams, and probably very few on high school teams.
So prior to the game, were you hearing anything over the loudspeaker? Was it all in Russian? Could you figure out what they were saying about what the crowd was supposed to be seeing here? When did you start to figure out what was going on?
Well, the buzzer went off. You know, the pregame activities, warm-ups were over. And then there was actually an introduction of players. We were lined up facing each other. And actually, when they introduced our team, they introduced us first in Russian and then in English. And then the English translation that we were the number one team from the United States.
That's what they said.
That's what they said. That's my memory.
From the
in shock.
The dream team.
The team dreaming. So we went out and lined up. And at that time, you know, we're talking to each other and saying, this can't be the case. And this is, you know, this is horrendous. And we were in shock.
What did you hear when they announced the Russian team? Did you know anything about who you were about to play?
Yes. I recognized some of the names because, again, they had played in 1972 in the Olympics.
So now you found out you're
it was the national
Russian
team
or the Soviet
Olympians. And they had this a little bit of an exchange of gifts. And again, the embarrassing part of that is that we had nothing because we didn't know it would be that kind of event. Some of us had gum and lifesavers, which were sort of a black market item you could exchange for lapel medallions and certain things. So a few of us gave them gum and lifesavers.
Which are probably confiscated. You guys are going to get creamed. What happens at the tip-off?
Well, at that point, we sent out I didn't start. Yeah. We sent out maybe the tallest five. And the irony there was that we didn't control the tip, but we got it. And one of our players panicked as soon as he got it, near half court, and threw it up and banked it in, which was wonderful. and it went downhill from there, though. I mean, they started pressing and everything. And
were they playing hard?
They were. We actually had one person who had an injury and had to be treated. So in the beginning, they were playing hard. It was 55-19, which I thought was pretty respectable at the half. But it was pretty intense. And when I finally got in, I was a pretty good shooter from outside, and I was able to hit one. And I heard somebody yell, Monty Tau. And Monty Tau was a player at North Carolina State that was pretty short. And he's actually one of their assistant coaches now. And
fascinating that the people who would be watching this basketball game would actually know the name of college athletes in the U.S., you know?
Well, I think, again, keep in mind that this was during the Cold War. And there was competition on all fronts, the nuclear weapons, outer space, as well as sports.
I'm talking with Dennis Streets about his role in a rather unexpectedly competitive game of basketball that he played in Leningrad back in 1974. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. By halftime, Dennis and his teammates, many of them wearing jeans and borrowed sneakers, were down 55-19. I asked Dennis what they said to each other at halftime, given how mismatched the game had become.
We were saying, let's just have a fun time. This is a lifetime experience. It really is one of these times that, again, it's not just what happens, what you do with what happens to you.
And did you relax? Did you start to
have fun? I think we did. We actually did, and we came back and made it a little more respectable. We actually ended up losing, I think it was 92-41.
So your opponents must have eased up a little bit.
They did, definitely. They let us have some shots, and I think they had clearly all this national team had seen enough experience that they knew this wasn't the number one team from the United States.
Was there ever a moment during the game, Dennis, when you had a chance to say anything to any of your opponents, to sort of just, I mean, I realize the language barrier is a tall one here, but was there any kind of communication?
Very little.
I wish I could say, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think they were probably frustrated because they may have very well believed they were going to play a quality team, the number one team for the United States.
They probably figured something out when you guys stepped on the court with your blue jeans and your borrowed sneakers.
Exactly.
What's the one thing that you remember most clearly from that game? What's your favorite memory?
Well, besides the shot I made, I think it really was coming and looking out at through that plate glass window and seeing that gymnasium full of people.
Now, I would have thought that would be a moment of almost panic.
Well, it was panic, but it was also excitement that there was something about to happen, and we had to make it happen, I think. And actually, it's funny what you said earlier, because in many ways in the second half, we really did feel like we were representing the United States. So we had to play as hard as we could with what skills we had. But also, I think, act respectfully. And so it really was in our heads that we were representing the United States.
So when you all got back on the van and went back to the hotel and told this story, were there people who went, nah, this didn't happen?
My brother was one of them. It took for him a while to hear it from other people to realize that this truly did happen. And then he regretted that he wasn't.
I was going to say, was he jealous that he didn't go along with you?
But it's true. I hope that maybe somebody out there who was among the team here might hear the story.
It'll probably show up in some as yet unopened Soviet archive box. The great victory over the number one team in the U.S. Dennis, thanks for coming in.
I enjoyed it very much.
And if you are one of those players who found yourself on the court there with Dennis Streets, get in touch with us. Let us know what you think of that experience. You can do that through our website at thestory.org. Dennis Streets lives in Pittsboro, North Carolina. Tomorrow on The Story, another look at the different ways that people are coping with the downturn in the housing market. Anne Trubeck was forced to rent her house when she couldn't sell it. Eventually, though, she had to throw the tenants out, putting their stuff on the street and then cleaning out the fridge and the freezer.
Somebody had bought like a quarter of a cow and had the pieces of the beef in the freezer with loin written on the outside. I mean, that was just felt terrible to take their food out.
What were you thinking while you were doing this?
I was so mad and I was so sad. I was so mad at them for not clearing out, but I was also so sad because it's just, you know, it's just a horrible thing, you know, to do. And it was horrible. Maybe I, you know, empathize as someone who had kind of screwed up herself with housing or something. I don't know. But I just felt like, yeah, they were trying to move out. I just didn't want to be the person who was in the middle of it all. But, of course, I got myself into the situation.
Anne Trubeck is my guest tomorrow on The Story as we talk about her role as the reluctant landlord, looking at different ways that people are coping with the housing crunch. By the way, if you're finding your way through that and you've got a story you'd like to share with me, go to our website, thestory.org. Leave me a note. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.